This is an ABC podcast.
Rugby star Israel Folau was sacked because of an anti-homosexual tweet. His employer, Rugby Australia, said the tweet was a clear breach of his employment contract. But for others, he was sacked for speaking his mind. This is Big Ideas on RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Just last week, the High Court ruled against a public servant who anonymously posted tweets critical of the federal government. She was in breach of the Public Service Code of Conduct, was the court's verdict. Where does this leave free speech? Writer and broadcaster Jeff Sparrow argues in an economy in which labour is your prime commodity, employers are now more able than ever to monitor your individual expressions and determine what you can and can't say. This, he says, makes free speech a crucial industrial issue.
So I'm going to be talking about freedom of speech, and by extension, that means I'm going to be talking about censorship. And because these two terms are so central to the contemporary culture wars, I think it's really important that we define what we mean if this conversation is going to be productive. Because too often in the culture wars, we find people talking at complete cross purposes to each other. And I'll give you a little vignette to illustrate what I mean. It's a kind of hypothetical example, but I'm sure you've all heard a version of it. The friend or the acquaintance or the old relative who comes up to you and says, there is too much censorship at my workplace. It's political correctness gone mad. You can't say anything anymore. There's too much censorship. And when you press them for details, they'll tell you about how they're quite the jokester, and over a long period of time, they've been accustomed to come to the lunchroom or wherever and regale their workmates with humorous stories. And they say that in the past, this was all fine. Everyone got into the spirit of it. These days, however, in this politically correct age, all of a sudden, everyone's telling me that my stories are homophobic and they don't like them and they make them feel bad. It's political correctness gone mad. It's censorship. We don't have freedom of speech anymore. And I guess the point that I want to make is as soon as you think about that story, even for a minute, it becomes clear that the person who's telling it to you isn't actually complaining about censorship. What they're complaining about is freedom of speech. Because, of course, in the past, there are all sorts of reasons why people may not have wanted to object to a homophobic joke in their workplace. For instance, if you identified yourself as being gay, or if, in fact, you identified yourself as being someone who was sympathetic to people who were gay, you perhaps faced the real prospect of sanctions at your workplace, up to and including being dismissed. After all, it's not that long ago, it was only in the 1990s, that it was illegal to engage in homosexual acts in Tasmania. Only in the 1990s did it become legal. So in that context where people felt under real threat of censure, if they identified themselves as gay or sympathetic to gay people, you can understand why they might not object to homophobic speech. Now, however, the political climate has shifted somewhat and they no longer feel under the same threat, and suddenly they're speaking up and saying, actually, I don't like those stories. Actually, I find that hurtful when you say those things. That is a classic expression of freedom of speech. It's not censorship at all. And I think this is really important to establish. It's not censorship when someone disagrees with you. It's not censorship when someone argues against you. So the point that I'm trying to make is that for censorship to be a meaningful concept, it has to be accompanied by a disparity in power, and it has to be accompanied by some type of genuine coercion, some sort of genuine sanctions to which the person is subjected. That's why the characteristic manifestation of censorship is state censorship. That is, when the government or a government agency says to you, if you express yourself in this way, you will be sent to jail or you'll be executed or you will be punished in some form or another. Now, I think it's quite legitimate to extend the concept of censorship away from purely state censorship, but I think it does have to have that element of coercion and it does have to have that element of power. Otherwise, it's not a meaningful concept. And I think that that's particularly important in the Australian context, because actually Australians like to think of themselves as happy-go-lucky and lackadaisical and anti-authoritarian. But in fact, Australia is a place that has one of the longest records of state censorship in the English-speaking world. I mean, I was talking before about the culture wars. One of the culture war flashpoints is, of course, the annual Australia Day celebrations. And every time January 26 rolls around, there's always somebody who says it's very important that we celebrate on this day because it's a chance to celebrate the freedoms we enjoy in Australia. And it always makes me laugh because I think, do you know what happened on that date? This was the date that the British Empire established an enormous prison in Australia. It's about as far as you could get from an occasion to celebrate freedom as one could possibly imagine. And because the state played such an important role in the establishment of settler colonialism in Australia, censorship has always been a key part of the Australian project, certainly through the 19th and most of the 20th century, which is really the golden age of censorship. I'll give you an example of the way censorship traditionally exerted itself in the Australian context. If you were to go, for instance, to an Australian university to do, say, an arts degree, what might be some of the titles that you would do in a first year English course, for instance? You might look at the development of the novel with Daniel Defoe. You might look at the social criticisms of Karl Marx. You might look at the novel in France with Maupassant or Zola or Balzac. You might look at early English modernism with James Joyce or D.H. Lawrence. You might go to America, look at J.D. Salinger or William Burroughs. Well, if you think about those authors and then ask yourselves which of them were at one stage or another censored in Australia, well, of course, it's a trick question because they all were. At one stage or another, all of those books were illegal in the Australian context. And that's, I guess, the point that I want to make throughout these remarks. I want to stress that the freedoms that we enjoy in Australia, the freedoms to read certain books and to express our opinions, have always been fought for. That people have gone to jail for our right to read certain books and publish certain books. That these things were never handed down from above. They were always fought for below. I remember a few years ago, I was doing a project on bookshops in Melbourne in the Edwardian period, and I was reading all these advertisements in the Labour press for a bookshop called Andrade's. It was in Bourke Street, and it sold various radical titles. And at the end of their ads, they would always have these curious little notices for books called things like The Wonders of Philosophy or The Harmony of Nature. And I could never work out what were these titles. And then I finally twigged. What they were selling were books on sex education and books on contraception. Because, of course, these books were censored under the Australian regime and had to be sold illegally. We're at a writers' festival, so to return to the question of literature. Throughout the 20th century in particular, there was an ongoing campaign to win the right to read, to publish and to read books that dealt openly with controversial subjects, particularly sex. You know, this is as late as 1946 in the Love Me Sailor trial. An author was sent from the court in handcuffs to Pentridge Jail for publishing a book that contained the word fuck. Or in fact, it didn't actually contain the word fuck, contained a synonym, I think it was frug or something. So people actually went to jail to win that right. And if you look at the history of censorship of books in Australia, one of the things that becomes really, really clear is the way censorship typically works, in that because it's to do with coercion exerted by power, it always targets groups in the population who are regarded as dangerous, and it targets those groups when those groups are regarded as weak and susceptible. So, for instance, if you look at the history of publishing in Australia, it's very, very clear that the authorities were always far stricter in cracking down on books that were intended for mass readerships as opposed to books that were intended for middle-class readerships. So it was always possible to get an exemption if, say, you were a literature professor and you wanted to import some French nudes in an expensive leather-bound edition, you could write to the customs office and these books would be allowed in. When they were published in a cheap paperback edition, the police would arrest people for possession of them. So the history of state censorship is this progression where you can see the particular constituencies who are seen as dangerous and susceptible to censorship. So when increasingly books became free of the censor, increasingly the censorship regime would move to film, because film was seen as a medium that was attractive to working class people who were the target of the censor. In fact, there are again and again, you read these accounts of people who would come to Australia in the 1950s and the 60s and think that there was a real penchant for experimental film in Australia, because they would go and see movies and then find them utterly incomprehensible. And that was because the censor would go through Hollywood titles, particularly if they contained sex and violence, and just cut scenes out from them with scissors so that the movies made no sense at all. When the right to watch movies more or less uncensored was won, then the censor's attention moved increasingly to video games. Video games were seen as a form that young working class kids engaged in. This was a population that was seen as both dangerous and susceptible to control. And that's preparatory to what I really want to get onto now, which is the way that modern censorship works. Because, of course, the traditional censorship regime that's exemplified in the Classification Board still exists on paper. In paper, every novel in Australia should go to classification because they deal with particular themes. But when I was interviewing the classification officers for a little book I wrote on censorship, one of the things they said is, well, we now regard the kind of people who read books as capable of looking after themselves. So that doesn't happen, even though on paper it should. The same way, all of the sort of sex shops that you see, I mean, most of them have died out now, but the sort of sex shops you'd see are in theory illegal, because on paper it is still illegal to sell in New South Wales or Victoria or the other states films that show people having genuine sex. But those laws aren't enforced anymore, partly because the internet has made old-fashioned censorship more or less irrelevant. Nevertheless, the old logic of censorship, that it's something that it's applied to particular populations who are regarded simultaneously as dangerous and as weak or susceptible in some way or another, still pertains. So I want to give you three examples of contemporary censorship. The first is the Northern Territory intervention of 2007. After extraordinary and very disturbing accounts of child abuse in Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory, the Northern Territory government brought out a report called Little Children Are Sacred, which they had produced after a prolonged consultation with Indigenous people, and put forward a whole series of, in my opinion, very sensible recommendations. They said the way to combat the scourge of child abuse in these communities is to empower the local communities to bring resources in to strengthen culture and communities, to give more self-determination, and so on and so forth. Basically, to empower the people to take control of this terrible situation and make sure that their kids were safe. Instead of implementing those recommendations, the Howard government announced the Northern Territory emergency intervention, where they did none of the things that were being recommended. Instead, they sent the army into Indigenous communities, ostensibly to fight child abuse. And they threw out all the recommendations, instead said, we're going to take a back-to-basics approach, which throws political correctness out of the window, and takes charge of these communities. They abolished the elected bodies. The censorship component came as part of that intervention. One of the things that was done is in prescribed communities, you could no longer drink alcohol or possess pornography. And in fact, these remote Indigenous communities suddenly had the strictest censorship laws anywhere in Australia. And lots of people don't know that because lots of people don't pay any attention to things that happen to Indigenous people. But the censorship laws were unprecedented that were imposed in those prescribed communities. And what it meant was suddenly people in some of the remotest areas in Australia had enormous signs above their houses saying, no alcohol, no pornography. And it illustrates the point that I'm making about the imposition of censorship being targeted groups that are seen as dangerous and groups that are seen as vulnerable, because there is no way this would have been done to any other group in the Australian population. Can you imagine a government sending in the army to deal with child abuse in a white community? Or perhaps say, I don't know, identifying the Catholic Church and saying, there's a lot of child abuse going on here, we need to send the army to occupy a cathedral. There is no way it would happen. Likewise, there is no way any other community would have enormous signs erected around their house saying the people who live here aren't allowed to consume pornography. And the irony was, of course, you go to these remote communities, there are no sex shops in places like Yuendamu. There's no internet, so there's almost no access to pornography of any kind. If you had to find somewhere in Australia where there was no porn, it would be these remote communities. And one of the things the people said was, look, if you want porn, go to Canberra. That's the one place where the sex industry is based, but there's no porn in Yuendamu. So that's the first example of contemporary state censorship, which you'll very rarely hear discussed in the so-called culture wars. And the second example, I think, is even more extreme, and again, never gets mentioned in the context of the culture wars, because if you want an instance of old-fashioned state censorship in Australia, you need look no further than the anti-terror laws that were imposed after 2001 and that have been updated every year ever since. Under these laws, for instance, the government can simply ban books. If you possess those books, you are sent to jail for a long period of time. Under these laws, it becomes illegal to express certain opinions. For instance, if you are found to be justifying acts of terror, then you can be sent to jail for a very long period of time. It's possible under these laws to ban political organisations. It's possible under these laws to ban political organisations if those organisations are found to be making statements justifying acts of terror. If that happens, anybody who belongs to that political organisation could be sent to jail for 10 years, even if they didn't agree with the statement that the organisation made. And this is, you know, irrespective of what you think of the necessity of these laws, this is an extraordinarily punitive regime of old-fashioned censorship. Yet, it is very, very rarely discussed in the Australian context. And again, we don't have to look too hard to understand why that is. It comes back to the point that I've been trying to make, that censorship is always imposed on communities that are seen as dangerous and communities that are seen as susceptible. Everyone knows, if you look at that legislation and, you know, the various civil liberties groups have written extensively about it, these laws are wide open for abuses. Why isn't there more of a fuss made about it? The reason why there's not more of a fuss made about it, because everybody knows if there's an abuse of power with these laws, it's not going to affect someone whose name is John, it's going to affect somebody whose name is Muhammad. And the Muslim community is one of the most vulnerable communities, which is why these laws were enabled to be passed and why there hasn't been more protests about it. And the same thing might be said about my third example of draconian censorship in the Australian context, and that applies to refugee detention. The refugee detention in Australia is not thought of in respect of censorship But there are three reasons why the implementation of mandatory offshore detention is basically an act of censorship. The first is one of the reasons why the government shifted from detaining refugees onshore to detaining them offshore was precisely to make sure that journalists couldn't get access to the people being detained. There's a famous account after the Children Overboard affair when someone working for Peter Reith talks about the importance of making sure journalists can't get photos that might humanise these people. And once you move them offshore, well, lo and behold, journalists can't get access to these people to humanise them. So, for instance, with the people that are being detained in Nauru, if you're a journalist and you want to visit Nauru to do a story about refugee detention there, if you approach the Australian government, and I tried to do this a few years ago, the Australian government says, it's not a matter for us. This is an independent country. You have to get permission from the government of Nauru before you can go to speak to these people. The government of Nauru says, sure, that's fine. You can go, but you have to apply for a journalist visa. They've raised journalist visas to be thousands of dollars. I think it's about $5,000 at the moment to apply for a visa. If you apply for a visa and you're knocked back, you don't get the money refunded, and you're always knocked back. So it increasingly becomes prohibitively expensive for journalists to do stories on refugees in detention. The second aspect by which refugee policy is a form of censorship is, of course, the censorship that's imposed of the people who are in detention themselves. Everybody by now knows the story of Behrouz Boochani, who is rapidly becoming one of Australia's most acclaimed and celebrated prize-winning authors. His book, No Friend But the Mountains, was written in conditions that are reminiscent of Samizdat in the old Soviet Union. It was tapped out on a phone that kept getting confiscated by guards and then put together by friends overseas when it was received through WhatsApp messages. That's the kind of censorship that's being applied to innocent people in detention under the custody of the Australian government. And the third manifestation of it, of course, is to do with the laws that were imposed on people who work in these detention centres, who were told, medical staff were told, if they report or leak details of what's been happening to these people in detention centres, they would be open for criminal prosecution and they would lose their jobs. So extraordinary degree of censorship being imposed through the refugee program. Why and how is it happening? Again, it's happened because this is seen as a population that's politically dangerous. It's also seen as a population that is susceptible to this kind of attack and not powerful enough to defend itself. So that's the context in which I want to make this claim that free speech is an industrial issue. And I want to make three arguments for why I think it's fundamentally an industrial issue. The first one is to do with the separation between our working lives and the rest of our lives, including our political lives. The most proud moment of the Australian industrial movement throughout the 19th century was the winning of the 8-hour day in 1856. Australia was one of the first countries in the world where the 8-hour day was achieved much earlier than in the United States, where people were still fighting for it well into the 1890s. Why was this so celebrated? Why were the celebrations so ecstatic when this industrial award was first achieved for building workers in 1856? Well, it wasn't simply because people were then able to work less in jobs that they didn't necessarily like. It wasn't simply to do with their conditions of work. It was also that the 8-hour day was seen as opening up citizenship to ordinary working people. So one of the banners of the time was that we would have 8 hours work, 8 hours rest, 8 hours to do what we will. And the idea was that people suddenly, rather than if they were not working 12 hours or 14 hours or 11 hours, they would have enough time to engage in educational activities, artistic activities, and political activities. That's the reason, for instance, why Melbourne Trades Hall is known as Melbourne Trades Hall and Literary Institute, because after the winning of the 8-hour day, suddenly people thought they have enough time to participate fully as a citizen, including by obtaining an education. And in a very real sense, the 8-hour day was the basis of a kind of liberal democratic system that prevailed in Australia through the 19th and most of the 20th century and is now being rolled back. A system in which ordinary people had the time and the basis to engage in politics and were able to see the time when they weren't working as their own time, where they could express their own opinions, even if those opinions were contrary to those of their employers. The idea was, while I'm at work, I'm working for you. While I'm at home, I can express my own opinions. Now, this, I would submit to you, is something that has been systematically rolled back over the previous decades. It's not simply that very few of us are actually working 8-hour days these days. I think it's very rare to find people who actually start at 9 and clock off at 5, as the day has been extended in various ways. But more profoundly than that, the distinction between work time and leisure time has been systematically eroded, with increasingly employers expecting or accepting as a right that they can control, that they can judge, and that they can punish you for things that you do when you're not at work. And the most obvious example, it's not the only example, the most obvious example pertains to social media. Increasingly, most of us, or many of us, are expected to use social media as part of our work. Very few of us get paid for doing so. We're expected to inject our own personalities and own sensibilities into our social media accounts. Again, we're not paid for doing so. And yet, when we post something online which offends the sensibilities of our bosses, we then lose our jobs. This is a very, very common pattern. You think of Scott McIntyre, you think of Yasmin Abdul-Mageed, and so on and so forth. People will express opinions on social media when they're not at work, and they will then be punished by their employers by losing their job. And I would suggest to you that this is a fundamental attack on freedom of speech, but also on our industrial rights. And I think this is a simple and important campaign that unions and others should engage on to win us back the right to have our own opinions separate from our employers in our own time. If they want us to use social media in our own time, we should be paid for that. And they should provide official accounts which are separate from our own accounts. And I think that's a fairly simple demand that should be put forward. The second one, I think it's connected to that, which is to do with the security of our jobs in an era of increasing precarity. And the most obvious example of this, I think, is the modern university. And I put that forward because the university usually features in debates about freedom of speech because it's such a focus for the culture war. There's this kind of presentation of the university as a place that's dominated by these radical professors who set the agenda and they are always censoring their students and getting them expelled and making them fail if they don't use the right words for a Muslim person or a transgender person or whatever. And the universities are places where political correctness has gone mad. Anybody who works in a university hears these descriptions and just gives a hollow laugh, because the universities aren't like that at all. Universities are billion-dollar businesses that are run by corporate managers who are paid obscene salaries. The average salary for a vice chancellor in 2016 was something like $900,000 a year, and most of them are on million-dollar salaries. At the same time, universities are places where these managers have imposed neoliberal management practices, a key element of which has been destroying the old tenure system and increasing casual and short-term employment. So the old tenure system meant that if you're an academic, you were guaranteed your position, and the idea was then you would be able to enjoy freedom to research whatever you wanted and to express controversial opinions because your employer wouldn't be able to punish you for it. Increasingly, I think in Victoria, it's about 75% of academics now are on either short-term contracts that are renewed from term to term or are entirely casual. And what this means, of course, is that the minute you express an opinion that damages the perception of the university in its core markets, and increasingly universities see themselves first and foremost as businesses that are based on charging full fee education to overseas students, the minute you say something that embarrasses the vice chancellor in front of his or her business cronies, there's nothing to prevent them from dismissing you because most of the staff don't know from term to term whether they'll have a job. So all they have to do is simply say to you, sorry, there's no work anymore. And then your job is gone. And increasingly how that manifests is that people self-censor. Because everybody who's in that precarious position, and most of those junior academics are often having to work other part-time jobs because the pay is now so low. Anybody who's in that position knows that most of the time, if your managers think you've said something controversial, there's not going to be a free speech campaign about it because nothing will be said. You just won't be called in to work when the next contracts are being handed out. And I use universities as the key example of this simply because they feature so much in the culture wars. But of course, it's far worse in other industries as well. I don't know if any of you followed the recent dispute in the chemist warehouse business. Chemist Warehouse, it's a discount chemist that has become incredibly successful at offering medication at a cheaper rate. The reason it's been able to do so is it employs, or traditionally it's employed most of its workforce, particularly in the warehouses, in conditions of extreme precarity, where people say that they don't know from day to day whether they will have work tomorrow. You get a call on Monday to say, come in for work on Tuesday. In the recent dispute there, it emerged that one of the things that was happening as a result of these conditions was a widespread culture of sexual harassment. Because, of course, in those insecure conditions, you are entirely susceptible to particular bosses as to whether or not you will get shifts or whatever. So it's a culture that is rife for abuse. And the abuses of freedom of speech is merely one facet of it. So, again, I think this is a simple industrial demand. If we want people to have the right to freedom of speech, we need to fight for the right to secure employment so we can express our opinions without fear of being dismissed. And that brings me to my third point, which is simply to say this, that if censorship is always based on coercion that's made possible by disparities of power, then it's fundamentally linked to inequality. And one of the reasons I think most of us increasingly feel that we're unable to exercise freedom of speech is that Australia has become a more and more unequal society. It's not simply that we have the tightest concentration of media ownership anywhere in the world. I think the latest figure is that the richest 1% of the population controls more wealth than the bottom 70% of the population. Now, how can you talk about a meaningful dialogue or any sense of equality of freedom of speech when you have such a disparity between the 1% and the 70%? So in that sense, the traditional goal of the union movement, which is to fight for social equality, is fundamentally linked to freedom of speech, even when it's not connected directly to a campaign for freedom of speech. Because the more equal the society becomes, the more capable most of us are of expressing our opinions without fear of censorship. So if you care about freedom of speech, join the union. Thanks.
Jeff Sparrow on why freedom of speech is an industrial issue.
You're with Paul Barclay on RN. And this is Big Ideas. Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app.
So where do we draw the line between free speech and hate speech? Words can be weapons. Free speech campaigner Jody Ginsberg, Professor Ray Langton of Cambridge University, and author Kenan Malik discuss whether speaking freely carries the responsibility of speaking no harm. Discussion host is publisher of the Griffith Review, Julianne Schultz.
So I'd like each of you to sort of address, as a sort of starting point, what you see as the purpose of freedom of speech, how you define it, is it an absolute, what are the limits, and how does it make sense in this day and age?
For me, free expression is the ability of all people to express themselves, whether that's in speech or dance, without fear of harm or persecution. And for me, it's absolutely fundamental. It's the bedrock of all other freedoms. If we can't express ourselves, we can't articulate our desires for change, for political alternatives. It's absolutely essential. And for me and for Index, the lines are fairly simple, but not simplistic, which is that you should be free to express all views and opinions except those which directly incite violence or where violence is likely to result as an imminent result of your speech.
Yeah.
I think free speech has many purposes, and I'll come to that in a minute, but I think also that there's something deeper which makes free speech important, which is what we are as human beings. As human beings, we are, or we like to think of ourselves as, morally autonomous beings. Free speech is an expression of our existence as morally autonomous beings. And that's why it seems to me it's crucially important. And restricting free speech, the more we restrict free speech, the more we restrict that sense of who we are. As for its purposes, there are a host of different purposes for free speech, but some of the most important is that in many ways it's a foundational liberty to all our other liberties, because it's the one that allows us to talk about what our liberties should be. If we're not able to talk freely about our liberties, then we won't have true liberties. It's also important to democracy. Mm-hmm. Without free speech, without the ability of people to be able to talk and express their opinions, whatever those opinions are, then democracy erodes. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people have talked about it as important for the elucidation of truth. In all these cases, of course, free speech can be problematic. So if you take the question of democracy, free speech includes the right to lie. So it's not that free speech doesn't come with problems. But the way I look at it is that without free speech, whatever its problems may be, without free speech, there can be no democracy. Mm-hmm. So whatever problems free speech may throw up in the functioning of democracy, mm-hmm. it's better to have those problems than to have restrictive free speech, which undermines democracy in itself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that some things that are said in the name of free speech are already undermining democracy. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of paradox, because things are said in the name of democracy that are undermining democracy, and things are said in the name of free speech that are undermining free speech in two ways. One is that some kinds of speech are working to silence the speech of other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that hate speech, some forms of hate speech are an example of that. I think that some forms of speech are working to spread lies and fake news. And those undermine democracy in a different way. They undermine democracy because they prevent us making informed choices about who's going to govern us. And as we know from the medical context, it's not really consent unless it's informed consent. And so if we care about democracy, we need to care about the forms of speech that are inimical to democracy itself. I agree that free speech is absolutely foundational. And if that's what you mean by absolute, I think that free speech is absolute. Mm. But some people mean by absolute that there should be no restrictions in any case on the uttering of words. And I think that actually nobody, even the staunchest defenders of free speech, would defend that. The US First Amendment has limits on shouting fire in a crowded theater. It has limits on, you know, if you want to sell some brand new medicine, you can't just tell lies about its efficacy. So there are all kinds of limits. You can't put up a whites only sign in your restaurant. Those are all things that we do with words. So in that sense, they're all speech. Of course, as I've been saying, they're not just expressions of ideas, but nor is hate speech just an expression of an idea. So we can agree that free speech is foundational. We can agree that it matters hugely. It matters to knowledge. It matters to self-expression. It matters to democracy. But precisely for those very reasons, we need to look very hard about the ways in which speech itself can be promoted, including making opportunities for more people to speak. Mm-hmm. And that involves thinking about it in a less simplistic way.
It's interesting, the issue you raised about putting up a whites-only sign in a restaurant. What is an issue there is not speech, but the practice of discrimination, i.e. not allowing non-whites into your restaurant. That's what the problem is, because quite rightly, we have an expectation that all people would be treated equally in the public sphere, and that's what that practice would undermine. Think about it in a different way. Suppose somebody would argue that only white should come into this country, only white immigration should be allowed. Seems to me I'm fundamentally opposed to that view, but it's also a legitimate view for someone to express, and I would defend their right to express it.
I would also defend their right to express a view. And here, you know, I want to remember what J.S. Mill said about the context sensitivity of the expression of a view. How in one sense, so Mill, who was one of the founding figures of our commitment to free speech as a liberal democracy, and who articulated beautifully the goal of truth and of freedom of expression, had the example of suppose somebody had the opinion that the corn dealers are the starvers of the poor. So he's writing in the 19th century, and they have this opinion and they write to the newspaper, and he says, of course, such an opinion should be respected and it's contributing to a debate. But suppose instead they were in front of the house of the corn dealer, and there was a huge mob there, and they were shouting with a megaphone, the corn dealers are the starvers of the poor. That would be a different thing. And then it would be much more like, so you have the very same words performing a different speech act. And that would be much more like the thing that I know both of you are concerned about, that sometimes the very same words can be, in that case, an incitement to violence. So you need to look at the context. And in some contexts, I would argue that the opinion that you just described can turn into something that is effectively working, like get out or a keep out or a whites only sign. You talked about practices of discrimination. I believe that certain patterns of trolling behavior are nowadays working as a pattern of discrimination that are, I'm not talking about whether they're designed that way, I'm talking about how they're functioning. They are functioning to say, get out of our playground. So they're saying, get off, get out of this. So that is not promoting speech, that is inimical to speech. So that's the kind of speech that I'm concerned about.
Jody?
I think we have to be really careful in this discussion around identifying what we consider to be, say, incitement to violence, the example of standing outside a merchant's house and effectively trolling them in the 19th century sense, and discrimination, for example, as Kenan said, with hate speech. And I think what tends to happen in all of these discussions is we conflate everything. And the danger of that is that people are very quick now to move into saying that certain kinds of speech are hateful and therefore should be outlawed, because in effect, that kind of speech encourages, as Ray has said, discrimination. But deciding that is incredibly difficult, because what might be somebody's hate speech is somebody else's essential speech. So, for example, if as a Christian you wanted to express your view and you believed that homosexuality was a sin, to somebody else that might be hate speech. That might be interpreted as something that is effectively saying that homosexuals shouldn't have rights, for example. And I think we need to be very, very careful when we get into those weeds, if you like, because what happens then is the danger is you move from being able to say, this is something that offends me, to you must not be able to say this because I'm interpreting what you are saying as hateful or discriminatory. And I think that's an incredibly dangerous track that we're moving down.
There are lots of real life examples of that. I remember an interesting debate in Britain about a decade ago, when it was just after the publication of the Danish cartoons, it was about a few months after, and quite unrelated issue. The Iqbal Tuqrani, who was then the chairman of the British Council of Muslims, was on national radio talking about homosexuality. He was very disparaging in expressing the Islamic view of homosexuality as he saw it. And he was very disparaging about homosexuality. And the Metropolitan Police launched an investigation into his comments as hate speech, at which point a dozen Muslim leaders in Britain wrote to the Times saying, this is outrageous. People should have the right to say what they wish without being interfered with. Now, those same leaders, just a few months earlier, had said of the Danish cartoons, that's unacceptable, we do not want that. We get to Jody's point that one person's hate speech is another person's essential speech. And the line between offence, hate speech, becomes very difficult to draw at times.
So one person's hate speech is another person's essential speech. This, what I'm concerned about in hearing this is, I completely acknowledge the context sensitivity of speech. In fact, I was arguing for it. The very same speech can be used in one way in one context. I mean, words are tools, just like you can use a hammer for lots of different jobs, cracking nuts or hammering nails. You can use the same words for performing lots of different speech acts, and in fact, the very same item, maybe. But that doesn't mean that we have to sort of sink into some kind of relativism, which says that, oh, well, you said this, but it could be interpreted this way, so we can't, there's no fact of the matter. I think there is a fact of the matter about what the speech is. And the fact that we disagree about it doesn't mean that each person's view is just as good as anyone else's. There's no need to be relativist about what the speech is, but that doesn't mean that we haven't got a very hard problem about finding out what the speech is, and then against that background of the difficulty of finding out what speech is, what the speech is doing, I completely agree that we need to be extremely cautious about jumping into the conclusion that this is doing something very harmful, and you certainly can't read off someone's righteous indignation that this is therefore a piece of hate speech. Of course not. I wanted to resist the implicit relativism that I was hearing, but I might have been mishearing it.
You know, when you say this is the fact of the matter, that this is hate speech, that sounds to me like you're saying, because I say it's hate speech, it is the fact of the matter. Who says, the point is that when people disagree about what is hate speech, it is necessarily relativistic to what people believe. Why should your opinion about what is hate speech be the fact of the matter, and somebody else's opinion that it's not hate speech not be the fact of the matter?
Sorry, I didn't at all mean it's my opinion. I meant there's a fact of the matter, but we might not know what the fact of the matter is.
But who knows what the fact of the matter is? This is the entire issue with defining hate speech, is that who is deciding the fact of the matter?
So I'm saying there's a huge difference between the how we find out at question and the what it is question. Sometimes only history will tell. So at the time of the Nazi examples and the other examples I didn't get into, the Rwanda examples, where massive campaigns about using describing the target group as cockroaches and so forth, which were the preamble to genocide. In those cases, it might not have been obvious to the people involved what it was, and it's only against the backdrop of a wider context you see what that is. But the fact that there are limits on our knowledge doesn't mean that there's no fact of the matter about what it is. But it does mean, and here I completely agree with you, that we can't just read off someone's righteous indignation, as I said, what the speech is. So I agree with you about the need for caution. But that doesn't mean that we think, oh, it's always just the expression of ideas. It might turn out to be something else. The whole point is it can be hostage to the context in ways that we don't always know. So, for instance, when someone is verbally assaulted, if you're happy to use the word assault like that, on a train, you know, like the one my friend saw, terrorist, we don't want your kind here, get out. That, to me, it's pretty clearly, and it's not just my subjective opinion, that is not the expression of a particular opinion. It is a doing something, which is an attempt to be something like a whites only sign. We don't want your kind here, get out. It might or might not be the part a practice. If it gets going and if more people do that, it will be a practice. Whether or not it's a practice, it's certainly not just the expression of an idea.
The real issue for me here is about, even if we could agree, you know, what constitutes hate speech or not, it's a question of what you do with that speech and whether you tackle speech or you tackle other things. So we talked earlier about whites only signs, discrimination, whether you deal with the discrimination, the act, or the speech itself. And increasingly, my concern is that we deal with the speech. Our first impulse is to tackle the speech. That's why increasingly we're seeing no platforming, the rise of no platforming in the US, our tendency is to want to shut down certain kinds of speech. And it's that's what I would like us to push back against.
But isn't the shutting down of the speech partly to go back to, you know, your starting position was it was speech which would lead to imminent violence. That was the where you drew the line. Whereas Ray's drawing a line further back and saying there are preconditions which we agree as a society or as you know, whatever, that we won't allow this, we won't allow that. Isn't the danger of your proposition that you only stop it at the point that it becomes violent? You've failed to accept responsibility along the way, not for closing down discussion, not for stopping an expression of ideas, but for mechanisms that lead almost inevitably to the violence that you're opposing.
Well, I think, so that makes a huge assumption about how far certain kinds of speech then lead to acts such as acts of violence. So I think that makes a huge assumption about whether or not, let's say, expressing a racist view leads to racial violence. And I think that is something that there is not sufficient evidence for. In the same way that, so let's take the case of extremism, which is one of the big issues at the moment. Governments are desperate to tackle violent extremism. We don't have enough evidence for that to say, if we stopped these kinds of speech, these kinds of acts would follow. And in fact, the alternative may be the case, that if we stop people expressing these hateful opinions, these terrible ideas, we simply push them underground. You don't stop people thinking things because you stop them saying them.
I agree with that. You said that by drawing the line only incited to violence, are you not absolving yourself of responsibility? I think it's the other way around. If we stop hate speech simply by censorship, what we're doing is we're absolving ourselves of the responsibility of challenging those ideas in public. We imagine by censoring those ideas, somehow those ideas have gone away. But they haven't. Milton made the point very well. He said, trying to stop such speech by censorship is a bit like gatekeeper in a park, trying to stop crows flying in by closing the gate. You don't get rid of those ideas. And it's our responsibility to challenge those ideas. And what we do by simply calling for censorship is we absolve ourselves of that responsibility. I would say that if you advocate free speech, it is morally incumbent upon you to challenge bigotry. So it's precisely because I want people to take responsibility for challenging hate speech and bigotry that I draw the line where I do.
As I was trying to get across, I'm not thinking that there's any straightforward link between saying there is no fundamental right to express hate speech that ranks people as inferior, deprives them of powers and rights, makes them count as inferior, legitimates discrimination. I spent the last part of thinking about solutions not talking about censorship. Yeah. I was talking about solutions which look to the possibility of more speech, where the speech of some is silencing the speech of others. The solution might not be to censor the heckler or the one who's drowning out. It might be to create more opportunities to others. So that would be a more speech solution. And I completely agree with what Kenon says about the responsibilities of ordinary individuals. We can actually agree about a huge amount of the actual practical conclusions. It's just that what the speech is doing is not expressing ideas. It's making people count as inferior, and this bears on whether there's a right to utter it. So we don't just say there's a right to utter speech that makes people count as worthless. So there are two things when we're thinking about the incitement to violence issue. One is whether it raises the probability of it, and that I agree is a difficult question, but history suggests that certain patterns that become practices of making people count as inferior through practices of dehumanizing speech, making people count as animal-like, which is what the Nazi propaganda did, which is what the Rwandan propaganda did when people were described as cockroaches. That was not an accidental preamble to the next part, which said, go and kill them or let them die.
Where does free speech end and hate speech begin? You can listen to the whole discussion online. There's a link on the Big Ideas webpage. In future weeks, I'll be bringing you another discussion from the Byron Writers Festival on free speech with Peter Grester, Kate McClymont and others. Look out for that one if you're interested. I'm Paul Barclay. That's it for This Big Ideas. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.